Hi, I'm David Crow, and this is The Infectious Myth. Thank you so much for being a listener to the show. I really appreciate the feedback that I'm getting, even if it's just great show, love it, that kind of stuff. That's great. And if you have a criticism, I want to hear that too. I especially want to hear your ideas for new guests. A lot of the guests I've had on the show have been suggestions from listeners. So I definitely appreciate that. I want to keep the good conversations going. Today I'm going to talk to myself again about Ebola and polio. I like to draw parallels between the diseases of today and the diseases of yesterday that supposedly were erased by the wonders of modern medicine, things like vaccination. It ain't so simple. Anyway, if you do want to contact me, email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can like us on facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth, and that's infectiousmyth without the. We're also on iTunes and any other podcast aggregator, so you should be able to download it to your phone, your MP3 player, however you prefer to listen, or you can listen to us live Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. So I think it's time to stop talking about Ebola. At the beginning of this epidemic, I had predicted to some people that interest in Ebola would soon wane, particularly because America was just starting its war with ISIS. Just as the U.S. had been starting the war against Iraq in 2003 with the SARS epidemic, well, I wasn't exactly accurate. Perhaps it's because the war against ISIS is more an embarrassment than a real threat. An embarrassment because it illustrates that the war in Iraq has not even created a stable dictatorship, and as soon as foreign troops leave, everything starts to fall apart. So all this talk about a stable democracy is obviously shown as a sham, and so I guess the American people didn't really take the war too seriously, apart from the brutal beheadings, which were a real shock, although those are the norm in places like Saudi Arabia, where it is their form of capital punishment, often done in public. But enough political diversions. Americans did pay attention to Ebola. Obviously, the message resonated that this is a risk to you. So Europeans, Americans, Canadians, a lot of Westerners paid real attention to Ebola because they felt that it could invade their country and cause deaths. And the fact that there were a couple of deaths in America definitely got people's attentions. But on the other hand, I was right, because the epidemic is now waning. It's not really been all that many months. It seems like it's been forever, but it's actually only been a few months. And I'll talk about that, because I think the goals of the people who promoted the Ebola hysteria have been reached now, financial goals. It's obviously claimed that in Africa, although in America and Europe, only a handful of people have died, and those all were supposedly infected in Africa. In Africa, it's supposed that thousands of people have died, many thousands. But if you think about the definition of Ebola, which varies a little bit, but basically four things are necessary: a fever, another symptom such as a severe headache or intestinal distress, and those, especially the headache symptom, is really up to the person who has the headache to tell you whether it's severe or not. Somebody with a strong pain threshold might say, oh, it's no big deal, whereas somebody else may claim that the same headache is life-threatening. So that's two symptoms. And the third, of course, is contact with an Ebola patient, which creates the illusion that we're dealing with an infectious epidemic. And the fourth is a positive test. So given the laxity of the definition of Ebola, it's not at all surprising that thousands of people in Africa, where everybody's in the Ebola zone, so they don't even need to ask if they've been in contact with an Ebola patient. It's just assumed that there's somebody around them who had Ebola. It's not surprising that thousands of people were diagnosed with this with this illness. And, you know, some of them were seriously ill and some of them died. Some of them were probably given drugs that they wouldn't have been given if they didn't think that they had this deadly epidemic. People were shunned and avoided, so they might not have got the supportive treatment that people do need when they're sick. They're getting dehydrated. And so the whole psychological impact of Ebola may have killed a lot of people. We really don't know, and it maybe we may never know. There may never be enough good information collected to really know what people were dying of in Africa. But even though there were thousands of people who were claimed to have died, it's really a drop in the bucket considering the other illnesses and conditions that kill many, many more Africans, many of them associated with poverty, lack of access to clean water, lack of access to nutritious food, especially to people who live in shanty towns on the edge of large cities, the lack of basic health care in many countries. These are things that kill millions of people every year in Africa, and they're generally ignored by the West because they're not seen as problems that can invade their countries. I looked a little bit more closely at the World Health Organization definition of Ebola, and it's actually very interesting because the definition seems to contradict what I just said. It says, suspected Ebola Marburg cases for routine surveillance, illness with onset of fever and no response to treatment for usual causes of fever in the area, and at least one of the following signs, bloody diarrhea, bleeding from the gums, bleeding into the eyes and urine. So that seems to say that for the World Health Organization, you need to have a hemorrhagic symptom, a bleeding symptom, in order to be diagnosed with Ebola. But it's actually not true. But as soon as an outbreak is declared, a different definition is used. And this requires fever or a bleeding episode or a sudden death. So all you need to be a suspected case, according to the World Health Organization, is a fever, and they probably also require that you have contact with an Ebola patient, another Ebola patient, and, of course, a positive test, and then you're a confirmed case. So it is really, in practice, the same as the CDC or the European definitions of fever, another symptom, contact with an Ebola patient, and the positive test. And generally the order in which the diagnosis is made is very important. First, they look for people with certain symptoms. Then they ask themselves, has this person been in contact with another Ebola patient? And then they do the test. So they don't find out that the test is actually a really lousy test because they don't run the test on the general population. As I mentioned in the last show, if they run the antibody test on the general population, they find that depending on the area you're in, 5, 10, 20% of people will test positive on the Ebola test without an Ebola epidemic occurring. So you either have to assume that actually Ebola is a widespread disease which causes minor symptoms in most people, which does not explain why there are these sudden outbreaks with a death rate over 50%. Or you have to say that and this makes a lot more sense, is that the Ebola test is actually really lousy. And the only reason the Ebola test seems to be accurate is because it's only ever given to people who've already achieved all the other diagnostic criteria. So if you have a nurse who suddenly comes down with a fever, they've obviously been treating Ebola patients. If the test is positive, then they've got Ebola and they're put into a sealed container and sent back to Europe if they're European. Otherwise, they're treated in Africa. And if they die, then they died of Ebola. And it's not because the doctors who were there in their desperation to do something gave them the most potent medicines they had and maybe killed them by over-medicating them or gave them an experimental medication because they had access to that. It will be considered an Ebola death. Another interesting thing about the World Health Organization definition is that there's another little caveat to the definition, which is that you don't need to have contact with a person or an animal with suspected Ebola if you've been in a mine. And Dr. David Raznick, who was on this show talking about Ebola recently, mentioned that there seemed to be a real association with mining, especially illegal gold mining. But nobody except a few of us radicals are thinking about environmental factors. The infectious disease people seem to think that there's some mysterious animal that lives in a mine that comes out to bite people every once in a while and causes Ebola. But other people would say, well, maybe the poor ventilation, maybe the toxic chemicals. There could be a number of environmental factors that could be causing people who are doing mining in Africa in bad conditions would be getting sick. The New England Journal of Medicine recently published a paper which studied 15 patients with confirmed Ebola from February and March of this year. Out of the 15 patients, 14 had a fever, 11 had diarrhea, 12 have vomiting. But this is part of the definition, and in fact, the people were only included in the study if they had some of those symptoms. So it's not really surprising that when they looked at them and said, what symptoms do they have, that they found fever, diarrhea, and vomiting, because those were how you became entered into the study. Out of the 15 patients, there was only one that didn't have one of these symptoms, and that was somebody who had a spontaneous abortion. And why this was considered Ebola, I have no idea, but the woman tested positive, so she was classified as an Ebola case. In terms of bleeding, 4 out of 15 had bleeding, but there was no word on how serious this bleeding was. The authors noted that blood samples were obtained from 20 patients who were hospitalized in this African country because of fever, diarrhea, vomiting, or hemorrhage. And as I said, the reason it's not surprising that everybody except the one woman with a spontaneous abortion had mostly 3 of those symptoms. But there were no other symptoms mentioned. So you would think that a disease that was somewhat unique would have some unusual symptom. But apart from the symptoms that they looked for in people to try to identify Ebola cases, there were no other symptoms worth mentioning. The authors commented, hemorrhage was not documented for most of the patients with confirmed disease at the time of sampling, but may have developed later in the course of the disease. So this is how they can, in their own minds, keep this idea that Ebola is a hemorrhagic fever, because they believe that they're catching this disease sooner, and if they'd left these people untreated, that they would have all come down with hemorrhagic symptoms, even though some of the people died without developing hemorrhagic symptoms. So that doesn't really seem to pan out, but this is what everybody believes. They then go on to say, the term Ebola virus disease, rather than the earlier term Ebola hemorrhagic fever, takes into account that hemorrhage is not seen in all patients and may help clinicians and public health officials in the early recognition of the disease. So as I have said numerous times, Ebola has become a non-hemorrhagic fever, basically a fever and a stomach ache, and contact with an Ebola patient and a positive test is all that you need. Now, I did mention earlier there were 20 patients, but I only mentioned 15 who had these symptoms. Well, that's because 5 of the patients with exactly the same symptoms tested negative on the PCR test, also known as the viral load test. So what does this say about the disease? If exactly the same symptoms can occur in people who test negative, you have to ask, how do we know that the virus is the cause in the cases where the virus is found, if you accept that the viral load test is actually testing for a virus? So how can we accept that the virus is the cause whenever it's found, when it's obviously not the cause when it's not found? But if we want to explain the same symptoms in all 20 people, and if we assume that there's a single cause, then we'd have to say it's not the virus. But even if we accept that fever, hemorrhaging, vomiting, diarrhea, if we can accept that there are multiple causes to that, which is obviously true, then there's no reason why we should think that just because a viral test is positive that that's actually the cause of the disease. It could be that the Ebola virus is not at all pathogenic, doesn't cause disease at all. It's just found in a lot of people in Africa, which seems to be the case when they do the antibody test. It's found in many, many people. But when they do these genetic tests, which are also not properly validated, they assume that every positive Ebola test is diagnostic of the cause of the illness. Speaking of hemorrhagic fever, it's interesting that reports of hemorrhagic fever in Darfur continue. Now, that's Northeast Africa, a long, long way from West Africa, where the Ebola epidemic is occurring. By mid-November, 81 cases of hemorrhagic fever had been reported in Darfur. So think about this for a moment. Here we have 81 cases, which are all hemorrhagic fever, and in West Africa, clearly only a minority of cases are hemorrhagic, and yet nobody's even whispering Ebola in Darfur. The word is simply not mentioned. There's no mention of it. There's no mention that people are being tested for Ebola to rule it out or tested for other types of hemorrhagic fever, and there's no other disease that is being postulated as the cause of the hemorrhagic fever. So why would they not want to test for Ebola in Darfur? Well, first of all, if they test for Ebola in Darfur and some of these people come up positive, 1,000 miles or more away from West Africa, then obviously the assurances that, the epidemic contained to West Africa would be shown to be false. And then the panic would expand. And this time it might not be possible to contain it. The panic might go all over the world, and then governments would be testing people, and people would be coming positive. And after a while, people would realize that it's a test that's the problem. We're not talking about a disease. We're talking about a test. Secondly, if in Darfur, let's say that half the people or a third or a quarter or even three-quarters of the people tested positive, it appears to be a single epidemic, so then people would be asking, well, if Ebola is the cause of this illness in say, half the people, but the other half the people test negative, then how accurate is the Ebola test, and how do we know for sure that Ebola is the cause? Maybe there's something else that's causing all 80 cases of hemorrhagic fever, and it's just that the Ebola test is testing false positive. So both of these things would damage the mainstream theory of Ebola, so it's best that everybody keep quiet and pretend that they didn't notice that hemorrhagic fever in Africa at the time of an Ebola epidemic might be Ebola. They don't want to know this. Going back to the earlier study in Africa of 15 patients, I should mention that out of the 15 patients who tested positive on the genetic test, which is also known as viral load or PCR, only 5 out of 15 had a positive culture or isolation. Now, this should be a more accurate indication of whether somebody has a virus or not. And yet, generally, it's not really taken too seriously. People like to do culture. They like to do isolation. But there's never any explanation of why 10 out of the 15 people who supposedly had the virus in their body could not have the virus cultured. I'm sure they'll come up with creative excuses for this, but one would think that virus isolation or culture would be a better indication of whether there was actually infectious virus in the person than a viral load or antibody test. Yet it's not that way at all. And only one of the people had virus found under the electron microscope. Now here, you're actually looking at what are believed to be viral particles, so you have to ask yourself why it was only found in one person. Another test specifically looked at genetic testing for Ebola, viral load, PCR. And the abstract of the paper claims that higher viral load helps predict fatal cases. Those who died generally had a higher viral load than those who survived. But they made the mistake of showing some graphs of the viral load, the antigens, which are the viral proteins, and the antibodies for three fatal cases and three cases in which people recovered. And basically, there was no difference except that one of the fatal cases had such a quick onset of about 2 days that there really were not enough samples to see the shape of the curve. But in the cases of the non-fatal cases, the antigens, which are supposedly the virus proteins, they went up and then went back down again. And this kind of makes sense because if the virus was invading your body and then the body turns around and successfully conquers it and starts to kill the virus faster than it replicate, you would expect the viral proteins to go up and then down again. But the same thing happened in the two of the three fatal cases for which there were enough days worth of data to be able to see this. Similarly, antibodies rose towards the end of the non-fatal cases experience, which again you would expect that if it was a viral disease, that when the body starts to produce antibodies, the amount of antigens would go down and the amount of antibodies would go up. In one case, this was quite steep, and in the other two cases, it wasn't really all that steep. But for the two of the three fatal cases, basically the same thing. One had a small rise in antibodies. One had a huge rise in antibodies. Now, if the antibodies are really combating the virus and the antigens are showing us how much of the virus there is, then in fatal cases, the antigen level should not fall as much and the antibody level should not rise as much, but there really was no distinction. But speaking of the PCR test, which everybody loves, we still don't know how well this will work on the general population. I wrote to one of the people at the Centers for Disease Control who was working on this and asked, what are the validation tests for this viral load that's being used in Africa? And I got no response because there really is no answer except that there probably has been no widespread validation of the PCR test. It would be incredibly surprising, and PCR is known to cause false positives because it's such a hypersensitive test. What if you did this test on 1,000 healthy people well outside the Ebola zone and found that 1% were positive? And maybe it could be a lot higher than that. The experience with the antibody test is, as I've said before, 5, 10, 20, 30% of people tested positive, depending on where these people were located. And nobody can really explain it, especially when there's no Ebola epidemic. If it was 1% positive, 1% of 300 million Americans is 3 million people, which is vastly more than the number of supposed Ebola cases. The first rule in modern science is, if you don't like the answer, don't ask the question. You'd think that real scientists would want to verify their tests in this way. They'd want to take the attitude that we're going to prove that these tests don't work. So we're going to test them on a bunch of healthy people, and if any significant percentage test positive, then we know we have a problem with this test. It certainly could not use the test alone to diagnose Ebola if that was the case. But if you want to commercialize a test or you want to get it used widely, you don't want to ask questions that could embarrass the test and make it look like it's not very good. So the epidemic of fear continued with Ebola, perhaps most bizarrely in India, where a man showed up from West Africa without any symptoms. He had a blood test, and then for some reason they decided to test all his secretions, including his semen. And so this appears to be now standard practice in India, that if you arrive from West Africa, I guess you have to masturbate for the doctors and they'll test your semen. And I don't know what they do for women, whether they insist on a vaginal swab. I really don't want to know. This just shows the absurdity of the fear. And if we look at the success of airport screening, this is what the Centers for Disease Control wrote very recently. In response to the Ebola epidemic, Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, and other international organizations collaborated in August to screen for Ebola persons at airports who were exiting countries with widespread transmission. Since the program began, an estimated 80,000 travelers have departed by air from the three countries with widespread Ebola transmission. In October, an enhanced U.S. entry screening program was begun at five U.S. airports as an added measure. Of almost 2,000 travelers screened, a total of 86, that's 4.3%, were referred to the CDC for additional evaluation. Of the 86, 7, that's 8.1% of the 86, were symptomatic and referred for medical evaluation. And now we need the drum roll, because the final result is that none of the 7 were diagnosed with Ebola. So the U.S. spent millions on an entry screening program, and they found not a single person with Ebola. And that's not even asking any questions about the accuracy of the Ebola test. Also, speaking of fear, in Guinea, in Africa, people protested against the construction of a new Ebola clinic. And this was kind of phrased in the media in the West as a bunch of ignorant people who just didn't understand what the heroic medical workers in the West were trying to do for them. They expected to be able to walk in, topple a statue, and be welcomed as heroes, just as happened in Iraq. And I think people who work for MSF probably think they are heroes. And I suppose they are, because they truly believe in these infectious epidemics. If the infectious epidemics aren't really true, then they're not really heroes, but I certainly don't believe that they believe that. But if you think about it from the point of view of the Africans, the West constructed the panic of Ebola, told people it was a deadly epidemic, it was easy to transmit, and you're going to bleed to death if you get it. So you can understand why people don't really want to have a clinic in their backyard with people with this deadly illness right next door, especially probably understanding how in Africa healthcare is incredibly corrupt, that some of the money designed to go into the clinic would leak out into local politicians' hands. The system would probably not work as well as expected, and probably some people would get sick with Ebola. It's a perfectly rational fear. So this strong reaction caused the government to back off and say, gee, maybe we should talk to the local people before we do this. But maybe people should critically think about the whole Ebola epidemic before they start telling everybody that it's a deadly disease. The Centers for Disease Control also did a little study recently to try to find out why healthcare workers were so affected and what kind of characteristics they had. They didn't even think that their definition of Ebola, and this is very, very similar to SARS, their definition requires contact with another Ebola patient. So who has contact with Ebola patients? Or think of it this way, who does an Ebola patient have contact with? Well, as soon as they're identified as an Ebola patient, the only people they have contact with are healthcare workers. So obviously, healthcare workers are going to be most likely to be exposed. Healthcare workers work in hazmat suits, very, very uncomfortable. In Africa, they must get incredibly hot. And it wouldn't be surprising if some of them come down with fevers, stomach aches, diarrhea, vomiting, and things like that. So it's quite obvious why healthcare workers are at greater risk for getting, quote, Ebola. And all the CDC studied from yet another study was that healthcare workers are mostly young adults who are slightly healthier than the population average. That's about all that they found. Otherwise, they're pretty much identical to all the other supposed Ebola victims. As the percentage of healthcare worker cases declined later in the epidemic, they were able to pat themselves on the back for the success of their infection control. So I was probably being a bit hard on myself when I said that my predictions weren't very accurate, because the Ebola panic is obviously declining. You can see this just from reading the mainstream media. There are many, many other things that are taking people's attention away from Ebola. The interest has definitely peaked, and I don't think that the public health officials and medical companies really care now, because they've got what they want. There's been big investments of money into the Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization. African countries have lots of money flowing in to build clinics for various other Ebola actions, and enough of that money is going to leak into the pockets of local politicians to keep them happy. GlaxoSmithKline has its vaccine trial well underway, and there's also a second vaccine from the Canadian Public Health Service that's being privatized to an American company. An obsequious article in the BBC, in the business section, not the health section, states, with the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine, 20 adults were tested. An immune response to Ebola was prompted in each of them. The vaccine was also, quote, well-tolerated by each of the people tested. It's a very encouraging first signal, Sir Andrew Witty, the chief executive of GlaxoSmithKline, told the BBC's business editor. This raises an important point. How do you test a vaccine, particularly for a rare disease like Ebola? You could, for example, vaccinate a bunch of people in, say, Liberia, and then a year later none of them have Ebola. Well, that would mean nothing, because the chances are that there's not going to be an Ebola epidemic for a few more years, and so you have no idea whether it actually protected them. So you could give a group a placebo, and you might find that none of them get Ebola either. So that still tells you nothing about the disease. So if you wanted to be more scientific, you could expose both the vaccinated and the placebo people to Ebola and see how many, with or without the vaccine, get sick. But I think you can see that there's ethical problems with that if you believe that Ebola is an infectious virus. I am certainly not sure about that, so probably nothing would happen, but then that would be even worse than the ethical problems. Because then you would, if you exposed people who got the placebo to Ebola and they didn't get sick, then you'd have to be asking questions about, well, how infectious is this disease, and what else don't we know about Ebola? But this problem with vaccines is actually quite widespread. Generally, vaccines like the HPV vaccine supposedly for cervical cancer, the vaccine is used to develop antibodies. And it is an assumption that if you artificially develop antibodies that are associated with protection from the disease, that it will actually protect you from the disease. There's absolutely no evidence for that. Another treatment for people with Ebola, well, a vaccine is not really a treatment, but a treatment for Ebola that people are now trying, is to inject people with the blood of people who survived the epidemic as a treatment for Ebola. I can't really see this being popular, because it's not going to be very profitable, so there's going to be no drug companies who are going to want to be selling blood from people who have had Ebola. This may be a relatively innocuous treatment, although fatal immune reactions to foreign blood are not uncommon, but it may be less toxic than some of the antiviral drugs that they will dream up, that they have dreamed up in the past. And now I wanted to switch gears to talk about polio, which is a really important infectious disease, because it's generally understood by everybody that polio is one of the big successes of modern medicine. There was a huge epidemic in the 1950s, a vaccine was developed, and then the epidemic went away. that's not true at all. And I was motivated to write something on polio when I read an article in a magazine promoting mandatory vaccination. And they used polio as one of the examples of why mandatory vaccination was a good idea. And one could imagine that in a African country with a true believer in the power of modern medicine in charge of the country, the mandatory vaccination for Ebola could become mandatory vaccination could become promoted for Ebola. And reading about mandatory vaccination raises the hackles on the back of my neck, because I know that whenever there's a progressive article about vaccination, and I use progressive in quotes, that's by left-leaning liberals, the opponents of vaccination will be portrayed as anti-science, ignorant, internet-surfing, crazy, self-centered, fundamentalist, religious, right-wing, uncaring libertarians. And that is usually approximately what happens. They avoid talking to any of the MDs or researchers who have changed their views on vaccination and who are now anti-vaccination. They will generally find a layperson to talk about why they don't like vaccination, and the more religiously motivated or morally motivated that person is, the better, because it makes them sound irrational. But I know that there are quite a number of mainstream scientists and doctors who are anti-vaccination. I wouldn't exactly call Andrew Wakefield anti-vaccination, but he's definitely being used as a whipping boy because he came up with some problems caused by the MMR vaccine, so they had to get rid of him. You may have listened to my interview a few months ago with Suzanne Humphreys, who is the author of the book Dissolving Illusions. She was a mainstream kidney specialist who started to notice that a lot of people showing up in the emergency room with kidney problems were people who'd been recently vaccinated. Her hospital didn't really want to know about this, but she did a lot of scientific and historical research, and I recommend her book Dissolving Illusions. I think that if you're still pro-vaccination, by the time you've finished reading that book, your mind will have changed completely. It's not that difficult to find information that's anti-vaccination or that questions the belief that vaccines are incredibly effective and incredibly safe. There's been a number of recent measles epidemics in mainly vaccinated populations. Now, somehow these are blamed on a couple of people who didn't get vaccinated, endangering the vaccinated population, but then you have to admit that the vaccine is not perfect immunity, and yet getting measles is supposed to be perfect immunity. I got measles probably in the early 1960s, a little bit before the first measles vaccine came out. And I verified that I was not vaccinated for measles. And I've never had measles again, so presumably I have perfect immunity, if measles is even an infectious disease. We also know that if you look at the statistics on infectious disease, most of them were rapidly declining prior to vaccination. But if you start your graph at about the time the vaccine became available, you see a decline that starts with the production of the vaccine. People who listen to the show are probably aware of the prominent CDC researcher Thompson, who published on his lawyer's website an admission that he had helped hide an association between autism and the MMR vaccine. You can read the Nobel Prize citation for Harold Zurhausen, who's the discoverer of the human papillomavirus, which is believed to be the cause of some cases of cervical cancer. The citation admits that it will be decades before we know whether the HPV vaccine reduces the risk of cervical cancer. So I don't understand how people can be pushing this vaccine when they don't actually yet know it's going to be effective. They know that the vaccine creates antibodies, but so what? The assumption is that those antibodies will reduce the risk of cervical cancer, but I think that's just an assumption. And surely adults have the right to think about the pros and cons, because vaccines do have side effects. Anyway, I said I was going to talk a little bit about polio, because polio is embedded in our minds as a big success. But we need to actually start thinking about the timing of the polio epidemic. The worst epidemics of polio were in 1952 and 1953, and 1952 was particularly bad. The polio vaccine field trial occurred in 1954 and vaccinated about 500,000 children. I don't know exactly what the U.S. population was there. It's lower, obviously, than it is today, but still 500,000 children is nothing. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the total U.S. population. So the vaccination field trial itself could not have reduced the rate of polio cases. The fact is that the polio epidemic was really burning out. And there's a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association that mentions that by 1960, only about half of the vulnerable population in America had been vaccinated. It's generally believed that herd immunity occurs when 80 or 90% of people are vaccinated. So you can't claim that herd immunity eliminated the epidemic. By 1960, the polio epidemic had virtually disappeared. Obviously, it was not caused by the vaccine. Not only that, but there was a rise in cases after the vaccination started. In British Columbia, in Canada, for example, vaccination started in 1955, the year after the field trial. Cases dropped from 480 in 54 to only 12 by 1958, which sounds good, but then increased to 165 in 1960. So there was a pretty significant increase before basically it dropped out of sight. There was also another epidemic, a Canada-wide epidemic in 1959, the highest incidence of polio since the pre-vaccination epidemic of 1953, even though the paper notes that close to half of Canadians under 40, only about half of Canadians under 40 had been vaccinated. So clearly it's not a very simple story between the vaccine and polio. Maybe the vaccine had some benefits, but you cannot say from the data that's available that the vaccine eliminated polio. I think that we need to start looking for environmental causes for polio. And I'm certainly not the first person to look for this. There were a few doctors in the 1950s who were postulating that DDT could be the cause of the 1952 polio epidemic or other similar chlorinated organochlorine pesticides. A researcher in New York City named Jim West, who I hope to interview fairly soon, has done a lot of research into the association between pesticides and polio. Prior to World War II, pesticides were largely based on arsenic. There was the cutely named, for example, Paris Green, which was an arsenic-based compound which also included lead. So these compounds were sprayed on fruit because, of course, when fruit is maturing, insects can scar the fruit. So just for cosmetic reasons, people want to make sure that there's no insects on the fruit. It reduces the value of the fruit. So if they're not properly cleaned, then you can get fruit going to market with arsenic on it, and some people are going to get sick. But this would just be speculation if it wasn't for observations about the seasonality of polio. This is one of the most remarkable features of polio epidemics, a feature that's impossible for virologists to explain. as far back as 1933, and probably before then, but there was a scientific paper in 1933 that studied numerous countries around the world and showed that there was a strong seasonality in most countries studied in both the northern and the southern hemisphere. In the northern hemisphere, cases occurred during the harvest season, August, September, and sometimes October. And in the southern hemisphere, it was at the opposite end of the year. There was a paper by a researcher named Gebhardt in 1946 who graphed data for several United States states and matched the harvest of fruits from the beginning of the summer, starting with strawberries, to the end of the summer, ending with apples. There's a remarkable correlation. I mean, there are correlations in biology and medicine, but they're usually not this strong. Utah in 1943 had less than 10 cases each month from January through July, but 43 cases in August, 211 in September, and 82 in October. New York had less than 10 cases January through May, but peaked at 300 in September. California had under 50 cases January through May, that's under 50 cases each month, but peaked at 590 cases in September. It's rare that such a strong correlation between two factors is found. I think in the 20th century until the 1960s, with people like Rachel Carson, not too many people gave too much thought to the toxicity of pesticides. There was some, but it really wasn't too much. And following World War II, the chemical DDT, which was basically a state secret during the Second World War, became widely available. You could get paint with DDT in it or underwear with DDT in it. The health and environmental consequences were not widely known, although there was some information about them. And even now when people say that DDT is non-toxic, it's not actually true. There are papers dating back to the middle of the 20th century that document toxicity of DDT to things like the liver. But now people would say, well, gee, you know, polio went away, the vaccine came, so maybe it shouldn't have taken all the credit, but it helped us eliminate polio to the point where it's the number of cases every year is hovering slightly above zero, and if it wasn't for the ignorance of people in the third world and the stupidity of people like the CIA who used the polio vaccination program to try to find bin Laden, we would have already eliminated polio. But that depends. It depends whether you define polio as paralysis with the presence of polio virus in a stool sample, then if that's what you define as polio, then yes, the virus has almost disappeared. But if you define polio as paralytic symptoms in a young person without any other explanation, such as a car accident or some other obvious reason why somebody would become paralyzed, then the World Health Organization calls it acute flaccid paralysis, AFP, and is happy to report that cases have increased from 2,377 in 1996 to over 100,000 globally in each of the years 2011, 2012, and 2014. We obviously don't have the count for 2011, 2012, 2013. We don't have the count for 2014 yet, obviously. So why is the World Health Organization happy that the number of cases have increased? Well, they have a belief which has no foundation in fact. They believe that the background rate of cases of unknown paralysis has always been with us, and the increase in cases is not real. It's only apparent, and it reflects a better job that the World Health Organization is doing in identifying all cases of paralysis. But even if that's true, what they're basically saying is that in 1996, there were also 100,000 cases of unexplained paralysis around the world, but the World Health Organization only found 2,377 of them. I mean, if we can believe that things have improved that much in case of, in terms of surveillance since then okay. But we still have 100,000 people every year, 100,000 young people who are becoming paralyzed without an explanation. And why is it that nobody seems to care about the fact that we have 100,000 young people who are becoming paralyzed, and the World Health Organization only really cares about the less than 1% of those who have polio in their stool samples. In what other causes has the World Health Organization considered? Well, obviously there's a long list of viruses that they claim can cause paralysis. There is an admission that the polio vaccine itself can cause paralysis. And actually, paralysis caused by vaccines is not all that uncommon. In the swine flu epidemic of the early 1970s, an epidemic that was started in panic when at the beginning of a year there was a soldier who died of what was called the swine flu, resulted in a massive vaccination campaign which had a huge number of technical issues and never really, luckily, never really vaccinated near as many people as they wanted to. But there were several hundred cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is essentially polio, caused by the vaccine. And there was a massive outlay of money from the U.S. government to the victims of the vaccination campaign. And the vaccination campaign did not protect anybody because, again, just like with polio, there was such a small percentage of people who were vaccinated that you can't declare that the vaccine program prevented the swine flu epidemic from occurring. There were simply no other cases of swine flu found that year. So the vaccination campaign was a total waste of time and caused severe illness in some people and caused a lot of money to be spent by the U.S. government, because the United States government is not the only government, has basically immunized private corporations from having to pay for the consequences of their vaccination campaigns. So if a vaccine causes paralysis, assuming that the association between the vaccine and the paralysis or the other serious symptoms are not denied, which is certainly the first step, then if there's any compensation, it gets paid by the government, not by the private corporation. Vaccine programs are kind of like nuclear power plants. Nobody would build them unless the government immunized them from the consequences. If there's a meltdown at a nuclear power plant, it's the government that pays. And if there are many serious adverse effects from a vaccination campaign, it's the government that pays. But, of course, we are the government, so basically the consequences of the mistakes of private corporations are paid by the taxpayer, the average guy, you and me. And so even just looking at the history of polio, if we get back to the question of the article that got me so upset in the first place, should we have mandatory vaccination? Well, that is based on the idea that vaccination has been almost perfectly safe and almost perfectly effective, that vaccination wiped out polio and it didn't really cause any bad things to happen. But we know that with polio, there was an increase in cases of paralysis following the vaccination program. Didn't go all the way back up to 1952, but there could have easily been other reasons for that. There was what was referred to as the Cutter incidents, where the Cutter Corporation's vaccine was blamed for the cases of vaccination that were occurring. And even in the field trial of 1954, it's not really clear how effective the vaccine was. There were 33 paralytic polio cases amongst those who were fully vaccinated and 110 among those who received the placebo. But 110 cases, you know, obviously is a lot more than 33. One thing that says is that the polio vaccine was not perfectly good because there were still 33 cases. But a bigger factor is that there were 124 paralytic cases in the 1954 field trial, which were classified as other. These included children who were never vaccinated or who did not get the complete series of three shots. Now, we need to know how many of those 124 cases were in the vaccination arm of the trial or in the placebo arm of the trial, and that information was simply not provided by the trial. So if the 124 other cases were significantly more than 50% in the vaccine arm of the trial, that would have been a good cover to make the vaccine look a whole lot better than it was. And the political pressure at the time in the mid-1950s was that the government had to come up with a solution. So it was pretty well, it was pretty clear that the polio field trial was going to be successful, that it was going to recommend the vaccine. There was really no other choice, because if they had said in 1955, sorry, but the field trial didn't seem to do any good, there would have been hell to pay. And luckily, the polio, the number of polio cases every year started to decline, and so the vast majority of people who didn't really think too carefully about the timelines breathed a sigh of relief and said, we're really glad that the vaccine was so effective. It is somewhat disheartening that after all of these years of infectious disease panics and reactions, that the people who are in charge of declaring that there is an epidemic are the same people who are in charge of determining what the response should be. They're the same people who are in charge of analyzing the response. And they always come up with the conclusion that the response of the public health officials is wonderful, and if it wasn't for them, the epidemic would have got so much bigger. And they're all heroes, and they've all, by them together, have solved the problem. So I'm looking forward to more episodes of The Infectious Myth. I encourage you again to write to me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. And remember that if you write to me with a nice comment, and you like me on Facebook, and you follow me on Twitter, you're eligible for what I consider to be very nice bookmarks that I've produced myself with my own photographs. And I'm sure you're the kind of person who likes to read a lot, so you'll appreciate these bookmarks, and they will enhance any book that you're reading. Hopefully it will be a book that's critical of medical paradigms. But even if it's a detective story, the bookmarks will, I'm sure, be very much appreciated by you. And they're appreciated by me as a way of saying thank you for listening to The Infectious Myth. And I look forward to talking to you next year at the same time. Goodbye.